Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale has become eerily prophetic since its 1985 publication. This chilling masterpiece regularly appears on banned book lists, a testament to its power, while simultaneously being embraced by millions worldwide. When Elizabeth Moss brought Offred to life in Hulu's acclaimed adaptation, the novel experienced a renaissance, with women donning the iconic red robes and white bonnets at protests for reproductive rights. Atwood herself has noted the unsettling reality that every atrocity depicted in her fictional Gilead has historical precedent somewhere in human history. "I made nothing up," she often reminds readers, a statement that transforms this dystopian tale from speculative fiction into a warning bell that continues to resonate across decades. The most terrifying aspect of Atwood's dystopia is not its brutality, but its plausibility. Through the narrator Offred's fragmented memories, we learn how the United States transformed into the theocratic Republic of Gilead with frightening efficiency. The process began subtly: the president assassinated, Congress machine-gunned, the Constitution temporarily suspended under the guise of emergency powers. Citizens barely registered these changes as permanent until it was too late, distracted by their daily routines and lulled by media assurances that the measures were temporary. One day, Offred, whose real name we never learn, attempts to buy cigarettes and discovers her bank card no longer works. When she calls the bank, she learns all women's accounts, marked with F instead of M, have been frozen. The bank representative speaks in rehearsed platitudes about new regulations, treating this fundamental rights violation as mere bureaucratic procedure. That same afternoon, she and all female employees at her library job are summarily dismissed. "It's the law," her director explains tearfully while armed men wait in the corridor, their presence a silent threat. Her husband Luke attempts to comfort her. "It's only a job," revealing his own failure to grasp the magnitude of what's happening. She feels fundamentally diminished. "I feel as if somebody cut off my feet." This visceral metaphor captures the crippling effect of losing economic independence. This gradual erosion of rights illustrates Atwood's most chilling insight. Freedom rarely disappears overnight. Instead, it evaporates slowly while people are distracted by daily concerns, each new restriction normalized by the previous one. As Offred reflects, "Nothing changes instantaneously. In a gradually heating bathtub, you'd be boiled to death before you knew it." Small protests were quickly quashed by authorities opening fire, and the population, stunned by terrorism blamed on Islamic fanatics, accepted increasing restrictions as necessary security measures. Women's rights vanished in sequence: first financial autonomy, then employment, property ownership, and finally, the right to read. What makes this narrative particularly haunting is how it mirrors historical patterns. The Nazi regime similarly eroded Jewish rights incrementally before implementing more drastic measures, first with professional restrictions, then property seizures, and finally deportations. Similar patterns emerged in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge and during China's Cultural Revolution, where society's transformation began with seemingly minor changes before escalating to wholesale persecution. By showing this process through Offred's bewildered perspective, Atwood forces us to confront uncomfortable questions. How vigilant are we about protecting our own freedoms? At what point do security measures become oppression? The novel suggests that the time to resist is not when rights are gone, but when they first begin to erode. In Gilead's world, environmental degradation, nuclear accidents, and rampant sexually transmitted diseases have devastated fertility rates, with birth defects and miscarriages becoming increasingly common. The regime's solution is the handmaid system, a calculated perversion of the biblical story of Jacob, Rachel, and her handmaid Bilhah. Fertile women with problematic pasts, divorcees, single mothers, lesbians, political dissidents, or simply women in second marriages, are forcibly separated from their families and transformed into reproductive vessels for the ruling class, their previous identities completely erased. The monthly ceremony that Offred endures perfectly encapsulates the system's dehumanizing nature. In a ritualized act of state-sanctioned rape, she lies between the legs of Commander Fred's wife, Serena Joy, while he mechanically attempts to impregnate her. This has nothing to do with passion or love or romance or any of those other notions we use to worship, Offred observes. This is purely business. Her body becomes state property, subjected to rigorous monitoring for pregnancy signs, monthly doctor examinations, and dietary restrictions. Any failure to conceive is automatically blamed on the handmaid, despite mounting evidence that many commanders are sterile. The system's psychological manipulation operates on multiple levels. At the Rachel and Leah Center, nicknamed the Red Center for the handmaid's crimson garments, ants, female enforcers who have chosen power over solidarity, employ sophisticated indoctrination techniques. These include religious propaganda, physical torture, sleep deprivation, and forced testifying sessions where women must confess past sins. During one particularly harrowing session, a woman named Janine is forced to confess to being gang-raped as a teenager. The aunts orchestrate the group to chant that it was her fault for leading them on, demonstrating how the regime weaponizes trauma and guilt to break down resistance. This brainwashing extends deeply into language and symbolism. Handmaids are stripped of their original names, becoming mere possessions denoted by of plus their commander's name, Offred, Offglen, Offwarren. Their ritualistic greetings, blessed be the fruit and may the Lord open, constantly reinforce their sole purpose as breeding vessels. Their prescribed clothing, floor-length red dresses with white wings framing their faces, serves multiple purposes, restricting their vision, marking them as walking wombs, and making them instantly recognizable and unable to escape. The system's particular insidiousness lies in how it cunningly appropriates feminist language while enforcing brutal patriarchal control. The aunts claim they're protecting women from sexual violence and creating a world where women can walk without fear, while simultaneously institutionalizing rape and oppression. They promise freedom from harassment while destroying freedom to make choices. As Offred astutely notes, there is more than one kind of freedom, freedom to and freedom from. This perversion of feminist principles helps justify the regime's actions to both its enforcers and victims, making resistance even more difficult. One of Atwood's most penetrating insights is how regimes exploit divisions among the oppressed. In Gilead, women actively participate in controlling other women through an intricately designed caste system. Wives, in ceremonial blue, manage households and maintain social order. Marthas, in utilitarian green, perform domestic labor and maintain households. Aunts, in severe brown, train and discipline handmaids with ruthless efficiency. Econo-wives, in multicolored stripes, serve lower-class men in all capacities. And unwomen, in drab gray, face slow death cleaning toxic waste in the colonies. This carefully constructed hierarchy creates deep-seated antagonism rather than solidarity. When Offred encounters a funeral procession of Econo-wives carrying a tiny miscarried fetus, they spit at her feet in contempt, viewing handmaids as both privileged and morally corrupt. The Marthas in her household, Rita and Cora, embody different responses to her position. Rita treats her with harsh disdain, refusing to engage beyond necessity, while Cora shows a pitying kindness that's almost equally degrading. Their different attitudes reflect the complex ways oppressed groups internalize and express their own powerlessness. Serena Joy's character represents a particularly bitter irony that Atwood develops throughout the novel. Before Gilead, she was a prominent conservative televangelist who passionately preached traditional values and insisted women should stay home. Now forced to live by her own rhetoric in its most extreme form, she's become a bitter, resentful figure trapped in the very cage she helped design. She doesn't make speeches anymore, Offred observes with pointed irony. She has become speechless. She stays in her home, but it doesn't seem to agree with her. Her carefully tended garden becomes both refuge and symbol of her confined existence. The ants represent perhaps the most complex and insidious betrayal of womankind. Led by the ruthlessly pragmatic Aunt Lydia, they've chosen limited power over resistance, justifying their systematic cruelty as a form of protection. There is more than one kind of freedom, Aunt Lydia lectures, revealing the twisted logic of oppression. In the days of anarchy, it was freedom too. Now you are being given freedom from. They enforce compliance through an arsenal of weapons, electric cattle prods, public hangings, psychological manipulation, and the constant threat of exile to the colonies. Their brown uniforms and military-style hierarchy create a parody of female empowerment. This sophisticated system brilliantly illustrates how oppressive regimes maintain control by dividing potential allies and offering limited privileges to those who enforce the rules. By making women complicit in each other's oppression through a complex web of social roles, surveillance, and mutual suspicion, Gilead prevents the formation of solidarity that might threaten the regime. Each caste is given just enough privilege to fear losing their position, creating a self-perpetuating system of control where the victims become the most effective enforcers of their own oppression. Commander Fred embodies the complex contradictions inherent in those who design oppressive systems yet remain fundamentally unsatisfied by them. During their forbidden evening meetings in his study, he reveals layers of loneliness and an aching desire for genuine connection, the very human needs his system has systematically destroyed. He invites Offred to play Scrabble, a seemingly innocent activity that becomes charged with danger and forbidden intimacy in a world where women are prohibited from reading or writing. These clandestine games become a metaphor for their relationship, structured, rule-bound, yet tinged with an illicit thrill. The commander's moments of doubt reveal the cracks in Gilead's facade. "What did we overlook?" he asks Offred during one evening, seeking her perspective on why their supposedly perfect society feels hollow. When Offred suggests they overlooked love, he dismisses it with practiced rhetoric. "Falling in love, that was the term, wasn't it? Arranged marriages have always worked out just as well, if not better." Yet his actions betray a deep dissatisfaction with the sterile world he helped create. Seeking Offred's company, taking her to Jezebel's, an underground brothel, asking for kisses, as if you meant it. He craves the very emotional authenticity his system has outlawed. The commander's vulnerability emerges most poignantly when Offred asks about the Latin phrase scratched in her closet, "Nolite te bastardes carborundorum," "don't let the bastards grind you down." His revelation that it was a schoolboy joke inadvertently confirms a darker truth, that the previous handmaid, who hanged herself, also visited his office and learned this phrase from him. When Offred suggests she shouldn't continue their meetings, he looks at me, with his candid boy's eyes suddenly filling with fear. This moment marks a subtle shift in power dynamics. She holds leverage over him through her potential suicide, a choice that would mark him as failing twice with his handmaids. Despite these glimpses of humanity, the commander remains fundamentally oblivious to the systemic suffering he perpetuates. His justification for Jezebel's existence reveals his hypocrisy. He claims it's necessary because nature's plan requires men to desire variety, while simultaneously enforcing a puritanical code on society at large. He maintains private spaces of indulgence while publicly championing restriction and control. His infamous declaration that better never means better for everyone, it always means worse for some, exposes the cold calculation behind Gilead's creation. This philosophy reveals him as both architect and prisoner of a system that sacrifices human connection for control, even as he secretly yearns for the very freedoms he has helped destroy. The commander's character serves as a warning about the self-deception of those who create oppressive systems. They may recognize the human cost on some level, but justify it through a combination of ideology and personal exception. His moments of vulnerability do not redeem him, but rather highlight the profound moral bankruptcy of believing one can maintain humanity while denying it to others. Throughout her captivity, Offred maintains her humanity through small acts of resistance. She steals butter to use as lotion, preserving her body as her own. She creates elaborate fantasies about setting fire to the house. She reconstructs her past through memory, refusing to let Gilead erase her identity. Most significantly, she tells her story, recording it for future listeners as testimony. "I tell, therefore you are," she explains to her imagined audience. By narrating her experience, she transforms from object to subject, reclaiming agency in a system designed to deny it. Her storytelling becomes an act of faith in future liberation. "I believe in you. I believe you exist. By telling you anything at all, I'm believing in you. By believing in you, I believe in the future." More concrete resistance appears through the May Day Underground movement. Offred's shopping partner, Ofglen, reveals herself as a member by using the password Mayday, from the French Mayday, help me. When Ofglen is discovered and commits suicide before arrest, she's replaced by a new Ofglen who warns Offred to clear her mind of such echoes. Moira, Offred's rebellious college friend, embodies more direct resistance. At the Red Center, she escapes by dismantling a toilet, attacking an aunt, and walking out in the aunt's uniform. Though she's eventually captured trying to cross the Canadian border and forced to work at Jezebel's, her defiance becomes legendary among the handmaids. Nick, the commander's chauffeur, represents a more ambiguous form of resistance. Initially appearing as a regime loyalist, he begins a sexual relationship with Offred that evolves from Serena Joy's arrangement, hoping to get Offred pregnant, into genuine connection. The historical notes suggest Nick was both an eye, secret police, and Mayday operative who arranged Offred's escape when her companion was discovered. These varied forms of resistance demonstrate that even in the most oppressive systems, human agency persists. As Offred observes, there's always something to occupy the mind. In a society that systematically erases history, remembering becomes revolutionary. Offred clings to memories of her husband Luke, their daughter, her feminist mother, and her friend Moira as lifelines to her former self. These memories appear as intrusions in her narrative, fragmentary, non-chronological, and sometimes contradictory, reflecting both trauma's impact on memory and her determination to preserve her past. Like pieces of a shattered mirror, each memory fragment reflects a different aspect of her lost world. Shopping trips with Luke, playground visits with her daughter, heated discussions with her activist mother, and late-night conversations with Moira at college. Particularly poignant are Offred's memories of her daughter, taken when she and Luke attempted to escape to Canada. The child would be 8 now, but Offred can only picture her as she was at 5, wearing yellow pajamas, drawing with crayons, asking endless questions about the world. These memories become both comfort and torment. When Serena Joy shows her a photograph of her daughter in a white dress, Offred realizes with horror that the girl has been told her mother is dead. "I have been obliterated for her." This erasure of maternal bonds represents Gilead's most profound violence, a systematic destruction of family ties that extends beyond physical separation to the manipulation of memory itself. Offred also preserves cultural memory through forbidden language and knowledge, turning words into weapons against forgetting. She savors words like valence and zygote during Scrabble games with the commander, each syllable a small act of defiance. She mentally recites banned pop lyrics and poems, from Amazing Grace to The Beatles, creating an internal soundtrack of resistance. She remembers the names of things, Tampax, Kleenex, CompuCount, that no longer exist, cataloging them like endangered species. These linguistic acts of preservation maintain continuity with the pre-Gilead world, creating an invisible bridge between past and present. The novel itself becomes an act of historical preservation through its framing device, transforming personal testimony into historical record. The historical notes epilogue reveals that Offred's narrative survived as a collection of cassette tapes discovered centuries later, hidden away like contraband in an old house. Professor Piaksoto's academic analysis, with its detached, occasionally sexist approach to Offred's testimony, demonstrates how easily personal suffering can be abstracted into historical data, reduced to footnotes and scholarly debates. Yet the very existence of Offred's narrative contradicts Gilead's attempt to silence women's voices, proving that even in the most oppressive circumstances, the act of remembering and recording can become a powerful form of resistance. Her memories, preserved on tape, become a testament to survival and a challenge to future generations to remember and understand. Perhaps the most disturbing aspect of Atwood's vision is how quickly humans normalize atrocity. Offred recalls Aunt Lydia's prediction. This may not seem ordinary to you now, but after a time, it will. Indeed, the daily rituals of Gilead, the ceremony, the shopping trips, the salvagings, public executions, acquire a routine quality that dulls their horror. This transformation from shock to acceptance happens gradually, like water wearing away stone, until what was once unthinkable becomes mundane. Offred describes becoming accustomed to seeing bodies hanging on the wall. I don't even pause anymore. When she sees men's bodies displayed with placards identifying them as abortion providers, she feels a blankness. What I feel is emptiness. What I feel is that I must not feel. This emotional numbing represents a survival mechanism that simultaneously enables the regime's continuation. The mind, overwhelmed by constant horror, creates protective barriers that ultimately serve the oppressor's interests. Even the site of her former gym, transformed into a detention center, becomes unremarkable, just another landmark in her circumscribed world. The normalization extends to language, creating a web of euphemisms that mask violence. Rape becomes ceremony. Execution becomes salvaging. Female genital mutilation in the colonies becomes processing. As Offred observes, I notice that the official language is returning to me, phrases buried in my head long ago. The regime's vocabulary infiltrates consciousness like a virus, replacing clear terms of violence with sanitized bureaucratic language. Words like transfer, allocation, and redemption hide brutal realities beneath bland administrative terminology. Even resistance becomes routinized, losing its edge of danger and defiance. Offred's illicit meetings with the commander lose their terror and become almost like a date, complete with magazines and Scrabble dames that feel absurdly normal in their abnormal context. Her passionate encounters with Nick transform into a habit, like cigarettes or alcohol, demonstrating how even forbidden acts can become domesticated. The human capacity to adapt, normally a strength, becomes a liability when it accommodates oppression, making the extraordinary ordinary through repetition. This normalization process has historical precedent in numerous totalitarian regimes. Holocaust survivor Primo Levi described how concentration camp inmates quickly adapted to unimaginable conditions, developing routines and hierarchies within the horror. Similar patterns emerged in Stalin's gulags and during China's Cultural Revolution. By depicting this psychological process, Atwood warns against our capacity to adjust to incremental losses of freedom and dignity, showing how societies can slide into authoritarianism not through sudden violence, but through gradual acceptance of the unacceptable. The novel's epilogue, set at an academic conference in 2195, provides crucial perspective on Gilead's eventual fall while raising unsettling questions about historical memory and interpretation. Professor Piaksoto's lecture reveals that Offred's story survived on cassette tapes, ingeniously labeled with music titles like Elvis Presley's Greatest Hits and Folk Songs of Lithuania as camouflage. While this confirms her successful escape, as someone must have recorded and preserved her narrative, the professor's clinical approach to her deeply personal testimony reveals the troubling way historical distance can sanitize trauma. Throughout his presentation, Piaksoto demonstrates the very patriarchal attitudes that enabled Gilead's rise. He makes light of serious matters, joking about the title The Handmaid's Tale being a pun on tale and tale, reducing her profound suffering to mere academic wordplay. His insistence on historical context and cultural relativism when discussing Gilead's atrocities, citing their demographic pressures and social challenges, mirrors modern apologetics for historical injustices. Most disturbingly, he fixates on identifying the commander, speculating between Frederick Waterford and B. Frederick Judd, while showing little interest in Offred's identity, which remains unknown. This scholarly erasure of her personhood ironically perpetuates the very dehumanization she experienced. The academic framing serves multiple sophisticated purposes. Beyond confirming Gilead's eventual downfall, it demonstrates how easily personal testimony can be stripped of its emotional truth through academic objectification. The conference's casual discussion of systematic rape, oppression, and murder as historical curiosities shows how time can normalize atrocities. The professor's focus on authenticating male figures while dismissing female experiences reveals that even in 2195, patriarchal perspectives persist in shaping historical narrative. Atwood's masterpiece functions as a multi-layered warning across time. By showing how rapidly rights can be stripped away through a combination of environmental crisis, religious fundamentalism, and systematic oppression, she demonstrates democracy's fragility. The novel illustrates how societies normalize the unthinkable through small, incremental changes. As Offred notes, nothing changes instantaneously. All of the changes were happening in the suspension of belief. The gradual acceptance of each new restriction, each loss of freedom, mirrors historical patterns of oppression. The novel's enduring power lies in its deliberate grounding in historical precedent. Every atrocity depicted has occurred somewhere in human history, from forced surrogate motherhood to public executions, from religious justification of oppression to the control of women's literacy. By weaving these historical elements into a possible American future, Atwood forces readers to confront uncomfortable parallels between Gilead and contemporary issues, debates over reproductive rights, the rise of religious extremism, environmental catastrophe, and surveillance culture. When readers recognize elements of Gilead in current events, whether in restrictions on women's autonomy, the manipulation of scripture for political ends, or the erosion of civil liberties in times of crisis, they experience the cognitive dissonance Atwood intended, the disturbing recognition that dystopia isn't merely a literary device, but a potential reality requiring constant vigilance to prevent.